"Look," she said in a rather choking kind of voice. I found it by the well." She handed it to Peter and sat down. The others thought she looked and sounded as if she might be going to cry. Edmund and Lucy eagerly bent forward to see what was in Peter's hand, a little bright thing that gleamed in the firelight.
"Well, I'm jiggered," said Peter, and his voice also sounded queer. Then he handed it to the others. All now saw what it was: a little chestnut, ordinary in size but extraordinarily heavy because it was made of pure gold, and the eyes in the horse's head were two tiny little rubies, or rather one was, for the other had been knocked out.
"I," said Lucy, "it's exactly like one of the golden chessmen we used to play with when we were kings and queens at Cair Paravel." "Cheer up, Sue," said Peter to his other sister.
"I can't help it," said Susan. "It brought back, oh, such lovely times. And I remembered playing chess with fauns and good giants and the mer people singing in the sea and my beautiful horse and
"Now," said Peter in quite a different voice, "it's about time we four started using our brains." "What about?" asked Edmund. "Have none of you guessed where we are?" said Peter.
Welcome to A Sacred Fellowship. This is episode 170, where your hosts, Catherine Olsen and Lorianne Schwenk, are discussing chapter 2 of Prince Caspian through the theme of coming home. We are using traditional, ancient, and diverse sacred practices to discern everyday themes in the world of Narnia. We are using these stories to learn, to reflect on our lives, and to think about life's big questions.
Take a seat in this treasure chamber or settle in your car and join us. Reading in community is an essential part of what it means for us to treat a text as sacred, and we're glad you're here to continue building fellowship with us. We believe that by finding the sacred in these writings of Lewis, we will learn to treat one another as sacred. And hello, Catherine.
Hello there.
Hello there. You got to go to a Red Sox game. I don't care if they lost. You got to go to the cathedral.
Know. I told my friend back in Boston, by the way, I went to church on Friday, and she's like, "What did I send her a picture from her seats along the th first baseline?" And she was so jealous.
Yeah, wonderful. So tell us about your tower and dungeon.
Oh, I think that my tower is, I've probably said this before, but I don't often get to have family visit. They're usually kind of in their homes and I need to go visit them because they've got a lot more to keep straight. But I've got three nephews on my brother's side of the family, and they all came with him and with my sister-in-law to visit, and we had so many adventures. Some of them hilarious, some of them not. Ask me again if there's a pool at the Cambridge Marriott Hotel.
Oh, okay.
Not discover this until my sister-in-law called to check if we needed to bring our own towels to the pool, and the front desk person said, "But we don't have a pool." And we
Oh,
just got on and laughed really hard, and the kids were very good about
good.
My dungeon is not that there was not a pool. My dungeon is that I'm just having a bit of a crash after the high point of this week, and so I'm trying to work my way back up from that. How about you?
I think my dungeon overall is that I've ended up taking time off from work because the stress at my job has ended up affecting my health. And so I'm spending a lot of time at doctor's offices. I have surrendered a lot of my blood. And it's weird thinking, okay, we're recording on a Sunday. I'm not going to work tomorrow. I'm not going to work. Things will get done or things won't get done, and it's not my problem right now. I have a different problem. So it's a strange place to be. I've never been in a situation like this. So those of you who pray, I bid your prayers. Those of you who don't, I bid your good thoughts. It's not fun. And tower is that in the process of slowing down and not going to work and not being stressed out every minute of every day, I had an experience on Friday morning where I noticed a spider web. And I've been walking past it, walking past it, walking past it, but on Friday I had time to stop and look. And that spider just told me everything I needed to know about this time off, that I really needed to slow down, really need the pause, really need the Sabbath. I needed things to stop. And there are many fun things I'm choosing not to do right now because I am just rebooting, absolutely hitting the refresh on everything. So it's mostly reporting from the dungeon, but my spider web, and I like the symbolism of how strong a spider web is. And of course what they do. So I'm just hoping to have the similar strength, and I'm hoping to catch the nasty flies and things and pests that have been affecting my health. So there's my metaphor, my sacred reading of a spider web.
I can't remember what exactly the circumstance was, but you were telling me that at some point someone was looking at the environmental friendliness of your office, if I'm not mistaken, and they observed that you did not kill a spider, and that was a sign of good intentions. And I feel like that spider web is obliquely a sign of the good thing.
There we are. Very good. Exactly. Yes. So if you haven't heard me talk about this, I leave a spider web intact at work. I don't just kill spiders. And so we got a green rating for our business. And one of the things we were asked was about integrated pest management. Well, it's not like we have a big garden or a farm or anything like that. But I said, actually, I do integrated pest management. I've got a spider. And I took the investigator out, and I showed her exactly where the spider was and her web. And I said, "We have no flies, we have no gnats, we have nothing in here, thanks to my little coworker here." So so I have a very fond feeling towards spiders in their place, and me and mine. There's some places I'm tall, so me and spider webs have not always been friends. But anyway, so thank you for remembering that. I appreciate that. And the Gammers have a lot this week. We have some interesting words in this chapter. So thank you, author, for going down some interesting linguistic terms. So we're going to re return to the word queer, and we heard that in our intro, and it's used a few times. It's a word from about the 1500s, so it's a pretty old word for strange, peculiar, odd, and eccentric. Probably Scottish, perhaps Low German. There's kind of a queer word, oblique, which means off-centered, which is related to the German quer, I'm guessing, quer, oblique, perverse, odd. There's an old High German, twer, oblique, and then we get to pi. So the Proto-Indo-European root is TERKW. Not even going to say it, but it means to twist. So compare it to cross, which is again coming from the same word, but the OED does not agree with that etymology. So there it is. But the meaning of appearing, feeling, or behaving otherwise than is usual or normal comes in the late 18th century. There's a colloquial sense of open to suspicion, doubtful as to honesty by the mid-18th century. As a slang noun, it has meant counterfeit money. To shove the queer was to pass counterfeit money. And Queer Street was the imaginary place where people in difficulties or shady characters lived. So it does not have to do anything with homosexuals until about 100 years ago. So when we're hearing queer, we're most often hearing these older senses of eccentric or open to suspicion. So I just like to remind folks that this is an old word that's traveled a long way to get where it is now. Could you tell us all about margarine?
Yes, and it says that it's originating from the French majoran, a chemical term in the 1800s given to a fatty substance obtained from animal and vegetable oils, coined by French chemist Michel Eugène Chevreul, 1786 to 1889, in 1813 from acide margaric or margaric acid, literally pearly, from Greek megarites, pearl, which is also tied to the name Margaret. So the crystals had a luster, and so they called them pearl-like. And now it's discarded in this sense as a chemical term, but preserved in margarine. And it's usually churned with ripened skim milk to a smooth emulsion and used like butter. And margaron is related to Greek for pearls, which is the margaritari. Okay, yes. Okay. Sorry.
Margaritari. Okay.
Margaritari.
Wonderful. So I didn't know this about the name Margaret, so I love it. But I did know that Pomona had to do with apples. So French is pomme, Pomme, and Pomona was the Roman goddess of fruit trees and their culture from the Latin pomum, apple, fruit. And in fact, I think apple has. Or pomme has always been a stand-in for all fruits. Again, one of my favorite words, synecdoche. Apple just means fruit, the way at some point deer meant any animal. So it's possibly from poemo, taken off or picked. Poomo or peomo are also conceivable, or perhaps they've been borrowed from a lost Mediterranean language. So there's a bit of a mystery. So I think it is a very old word, and not surprising that it would get tied up with the first garden. And of course, later we're going to go to the garden using Pardes for our sacred reading. So I like that we have apples and gardens all throughout this chapter. And you've
And
got one more word for us.
carbuncle, which I have to say I feel very silly because I kept on thinking of the word carbuncle as the same thing as barnacle, and no, that's not remotely related to each other.
I did the same. I assumed it was the same.
Well, that makes me feel better. But it is from the early 13th century, a fiery jewel gem of a deep red color, ruby, also the name of a semi-mythical gem from the East Indies, formerly believed to be capable of shining in the dark. Just finished reading The Hobbit again. It reminds me of the
Arkenstone.
Arkstone.
The Arkenstone is a great carbuncle.
It's from the Old North French carbuncle, or Old French charboncle, or charboncle. Carbuncle stone. I also apologize in advance if I'm completely butchering this, Eve. I only know so much French, and you know a lot more and are very kind, or anyone else who likes to help out with such things. But also, it is a carbuncle stone, or carbuncle, or boil from carbunculus, which is a red gem, or also red inflamed spot. It is literally a little coal from carbo, like carbonus. Or coal, see carbon.
Right. So
Only
I
of
love that carbon is being related to carbuncle.
And then it's originally of rubies, garnets, and other red jewels. And it was used of red eruptive subcutaneous inflammations and tumors from the late 14th century. Also, a red spot on the nose or face caused by intemperance.
I love that. These two completely different meanings. Either you've got some red blotch on your face, or you have a beautiful garnet gem. Like, I love how one word can be both. I think it's fantastic. So bring us home. Do you have a theme story for us? Coming home is our theme.
Oh, yes, I'm going to tell a story of a visit I had several years ago that kind of led to my current situation. I had these friends who lived in Lowell, and I came out to visit for one of the kids' birthdays, and on my way back to the airport, they were driving me, so we decided to stop at a playground, which was fun, and I had already had a wonderful time on this trip, but I looked forward to just playing with the kids a little more. But as we came over the hill, I completely forgot that Arlington Heights is, of course, part of the area that is referred to as Arlmont. And Belmont is part of the same highway exit as Arlmont. I discovered this the first time we got lost trying to go to Belmont. But Belmont is significant to me because it is the location of my church's temple in the Boston area. And I would drive to school in 11th and 12th grade. I would see this temple being built on the hill because it wasn't finished until 2000. But for me, every time I go down Route 2, I think of this temple because it was such a long, hard journey to get it built. And also, the court cases against the church brought to its completion. And so, like I said, we were coming over this hill. And in Arlmont, all of a sudden it turned into Belmont, and I saw the temple on the horizon, and I clapped a hand to my chest, and my friend said, "Oh, you just came home, didn't you?" And so, of course, for me, coming home really is encapsulated in all of the literal thoughts and prayers that I poured into that experience of being able to find a place like that, emblematic. Everything our church has stood for in this area is something that I associate with that temple.
Fantastic. I love it. Well, I think when Peter helps these children realize where they are, there must be some gasps and clutching going on. So,
I think certainly for Susan, poor a girl.
poor girl, yes. So, is it all right if we head into the chapter now? I love your story. And of course, I always feel at home too, because I know exactly what roads you're on. I left Massachusetts in 2000, but I know exactly where you are. It's marvelous. Are we ready for the book, for the chapter?
I am. I'm curious if you found anything in the first couple of paragraphs because I actually did not until a little bit into the chapter.
Well, I did, and maybe I'm reaching, stretching, reaching. Just because this wasn't a garden, said Susan presently. Again, the very first sentence, it was a castle, and this must have been the courtyard. So she feels at home enough in the architecture to be describing it, even though it's a ruin, and even though she doesn't know yet that this is Caraparaville, she knows castles. So she is at home in this style of architecture. In the same way that if I were plopped into the ruins of a church, I could tell you where the altar was. I could tell you where, the choir was. I could tell you where the sacristy was. I could tell you a lot. Even if it was just the outline on the ground, I could probably tell you a lot. And so she is kind of at home in the same kind of thing. This she's in her comfort zone. And Peter agrees right away. They are using past knowledge to inform the present. And that's a way of being at home. There is something from the past is informing their present. And so they are much more comfortable in this space because of that past experience.
Very true.
And then when Lucy says that the place gives her a queer feeling, Peter says, "Does it, Lou?" Turning and looking hard at her, because it does the same to me. It is the queerest thing that has happened this queer day. I wonder where we are and what it all means. And I get a sense of, that it, things are starting to dawn on Peter. And so he is trying to be the anchor and home for his siblings. He is, I'm sure he's always kind of in a leadership position, but he is really coming home to his role as king, not quite yet. We're a few words away from that, but he is asking the right questions to figure out where they are. And I like that he's at home enough to be asking questions, as opposed to saying, this is dangerous, we should get away. I mean, there's so many other things they could be doing. And yet he is feeling safe enough to start wondering where they are and what it all means. So he feels safe there. I'm taking a long way to say that, but if you're safe enough to be meaning making, you're quote on at home, unquote. So.
I agree with that. And then I personally found that this is him returning a little bit to the time that he was a king and his sisters were king queens and his brother was a king, this is something where they never outright say that any of them took precedence or that any of them was elevated above them. And so I have this idyllic thought in my mind where the kings and queens of Narnia were on a level and treated each other as counselors. And so him turning to her for enlightenment and advice is something that has settled both back into the role that he filled it here in Narnia. And we
Excellent.
Saw a little bit of it when he was more on an equitable level with her during the prologue to all of this.
Right.
But I feel he has brought himself back to the person he meant himself to be as a king.
Ah, well, well, well put. I really like that. I also never noticed that you could nickname both girls Lou and Sue. And so I think there's that sweet kind of affection that he feels because he does call his sisters Lou and Sue, and I like that. And then somehow or other, you know, they're getting closer to it, and Peter's saying, "Why, you silly?" So again, he's very comfortable with his siblings here. He has come home and he's strangely excited. "Don't you see? That's where the high table was. Anyone would think you had forgotten that we ourselves were once kings and queens." So he knows he has come home. Anything more on that for you?
I'm wondering personally if Susan, in the moment where she says, "In their castle of Cara Pervel," continued Susan in a dreamy and rather sing-song voice, "at the mouth of the great river of Narnia, how could I forget?" I find it peculiar that she's speaking in this dreamy manner and almost telling it as a fairy tale to herself, where it I understand that they're not yet aware that this is Cara Paravel, but it seems as though she should be feeling more grounded here than she is at the moment, and so she doesn't quite believe it. And I may come back to this point a lot later when we get to a story of Lucy seeing something that the others aren't able to yet, but that's for another time.
For another time, for another time. Right. Well, and it's interesting that Susan in her dreamy voice is pointing out the thing that's different, the mouth of the great river of Narnia, but here they're on an island. So she's still not entirely convinced. But it's also a little bit of this timey-wimey, wibbly-wobbly stuff that it's all coming back. And Lucy, really, it comes back fast for her. Except she says, "We could pretend we're in Cara Paravel now. This hall must have been very like the Great Hall." And I like how Edmund, he's coming home. He's pointing out that evening is coming. It's cooling off. We'll need a fire. So he and Peter start doing some practical things towards making themselves more at home. So they are coming home. They're going to collect some wood and make a fire. So very sensible. And then they find the well.
Well, I had that section highlighted for a slightly different reason because they see them almost roughing it within this castle, which is a very nonsensical way to think of a castle. But I can't decide if they have these outdoorsy and practical skills from having spend time in the country as a family, or if they have these skills from having been a very sallying forth kind of monarchy. Like they, we had them in the first book going out on a hunt, which is not necessarily something that all people do, but I don't know. It's something that I can see them exploring the world of Narnia in a less formal way than other people might because they were not born into their roles as kings and queens. And
sure.
So the fact that people who were, you know, wearing crowns are going about and finding things in the weeds and picking up wood and trying to build a fire and that sort of thing and experimenting with torches to very little effect.
That's a good question. And I think I was thinking about that as well. And wondering, you know, had they done some camping? But usually, I mean, if you're a child and you're going camping, then an adult sort of takes care of all the stuff, you know, things like that. You might get sent off to find a few twigs, but dad's gonna light the fire or whatever. So I am thinking that you might be on the right path there, that yes, if they went off on a hunt, it may not have been for the afternoon. It might have been for 3 weeks, where they might have gone off places and explored and roughed it a bit, because it was a way to get to know Narnia even better and to know their realm even better. So I'm wondering, because I see this gradually throughout the chapter, that their skills are coming back to them. So I'm thinking I'm more in line with the idea that this is it, deep inside them from their time before. I like that.
So yes, then they find the well.
Yes, exactly. And all they have still is apples, and they did get to light their fire in the end. This is not like a Twilight Zone story where they finally get the fire going and then a wind blows it out and they have no more matches. No, it's not that. But roast apples didn't taste so good. I would think roast apples would be fine. Edmund would like a thick slice of bread and margarine. I never want a th margarine ever. So I didn't look up the history of it, but wonder if that was a wartime thing. Anyway, you know, that there would have been a way to make make milk go farther instead of making just whole butter, making margarine with other vegetable oils or animal oils. But the spirit of adventure is rising in them all. And I think that's, again, they're coming home.
Yes.
For them, that's the adventure. And then we find this little chess piece. And I love that.
I sort of feel sorry for Susan that she had to discover this chess piece and be in a state of uncertainty on her own before she came back to her siblings. All of them got to experience it at the same time and come to a community decision about what it meant to them, but she must have been in a state of kind of confusion. I mean, there's the queerness that they're all feeling, but this is something that has a physical effect on her.
Right. What do you think that physical effect is?
It's kind of hard to describe. No, I'm not going to interpose my own physical experience with something because it doesn't actually make sense, but I f feel as though she might. There's a description of something where people say that they feel as though they've missed a step in going down a staircase, something jarring to them that makes them feel as though they're off balance, and I feel that Susan might be in a state of this off-kilter nature at the moment.
I think that makes sense. And so it's a bit of being at home and also being really lost at the same time. And the implications of finding this chess piece, the fact that it is so specifically like what they had in this previous time, makes me almost wonder if Susan has started to think this was all just games that they'd played and it never happened. And yet now there's this incarnational object, not just a ruined castle, which could be built like any other castle, but there's this really specific thing. So I think that's interesting that Peter's easy with it. He's convinced already. And Lucy's pretty darn close. And then Peter confirms it. They have come home. They're in the ruins. And I love how he's able to present a bulleted outline right off the bat. So
Our PowerPoint presentation of the argument for Care Bearville.
yes, exactly. With 8x10 glossy photos with circles and arrows. So Edmund, of course, points out why this can't be, but Peter has 4 points and he wants to take the points one by one. It's exactly the same shape and size. It is the castle well is exactly where our well was. Third point, Susan has just found one of her old chessmen. And fourth point, don't you remember? It was the very day before the ambassadors came, blah, blah, blah. Don't you remember planting the orchard outside the north gate? The greatest of all the wood peoples, Pomona herself, came to put the good spells on it. So, and I love the line, believe me, your majesty, you'll be glad of these fruit trees one day. Peter says, by Jove. They were right. He was right. So I think that's marvelous. And I love the fact that there is almost this elvish manner of knowing the future of this chief mole who knows that they'll all be glad of these fruit trees. So he wins his point.
Oh no, it's not the time for me to start getting ideas for a story based on the fact that moles are apparently clairvoyant based on earth things.
There you go. Okay. Put that note aside, but
Just like, of course the mole knows what the ground shall produce. He's inside the ground for the most of the part, so.
exactly right. He knows the orchard will spread and that someday these children will come back and they'll be glad of the apples. So he knows that. No problem. And so Edmund discusses the timey-wiminess of it, but Peter's not bothered by that. Lucy points out that there should be a door, and they decide they're going to look for the door. But this is when Susan gets a little motherish. Oh, let's leave it alone. We can try in the morning. If we've got to spend the night here, I don't want an open door at my back and a great big black hole, and blah blah, and it'll soon be dark. So she is that coming home for her? Is that a sense of home for her?
I think it's more sense of home that this is her natural state and her children, not her children, her siblings,
Her
sorry,
siblings, right.
her siblings who she treats like children are all kind of not exactly fed up with it, but they expected her to be like this until they reached Narnia and it should have taken them to a different place in their characters. And why is she so utterly non-Narnian at this point?
Yeah,
Doesn't she have
really.
wonder?
Right. But they head down and they get in the hall. It's interesting. Susan was not the only one who felt a slight shudder as the boys stood above the pile of splintered wood, now for a torch. And oh, what is the good? Said Susan. And as Edmund said, I'm not saying it now, Edmund interrupted. So they head down. Cheer up, Susan. It's no good behaving like kids now that we're back in Narnia. You're a queen here. I like that. So he is reminding them they have come home here. And they don't want to go to sleep with a mystery on their minds.
Also, I feel like there's a sense of reassurance that he's trying to give her. It's not a moment of him saying, "You're a queen here, shape up."
Yeah.
It's a, "You're a queen here, you have power in this place."
Yeah. I like that. Yes, no, I think that's absolutely right. Oh, I don't hear him. Yeah, I don't hear him saying get it together or shape up or put on your big girl panties or anything. Right. So interesting that long sticks as torches don't work, because I swear in the movies they always do. I don't know. How to make a torch. One of these days I need to know that, but Edmund has his electric torch, so while that battery lasts, so I'm glad. And that's me worrying. That's the Susan in me anxious about that battery. But but they've gone down and it's got the same number of stairs. They know exactly. Yeah, it's everything's confirming where they are.
I love that they still remember the number of stairs. I wonder what other things they counted in Narnia that they remembered on their long nights in England.
Yeah. Oh, I like that. Funny line here. There was a kind of path up the middle, as it might be in a greenhouse.
Yes.
What do you think of that comparison?
I feel as though a greenhouse is used here. I mean, for me, if there's something there's that there's a path up the middle, well, this is a church, not a greenhouse or a treasure chamber. But with a greenhouse, things are in their order and expected to be in the correct place.
Okay.
What was your read?
So it's yeah, oh, I you know how Mary Magdalene thinks Jesus is the gardener in
Yes.
John? That's kind of where I went in this, in that the treasure that is here in this room, in this treasure house, is in a way a garden. So it's not about the monetary value or the rarity or anything like these. I think there is well, whatever a garden represents is what is in here. And for one thing, they all now know this is indeed their ancient treasure chamber. So it's already bearing fruit in that way. And then, as we'll see in a little bit, after they've looked at the diamonds, rubies, and carbuncles and everything else, other things start to happen to them in terms of coming home. So in a way, this greenhouse is nourishing them in some way. So I kind of went metaphorical there. Maybe this would have been better for our sacred reading than the thing I chose, but we'll find out. That
Sacred reading, that's kind of the point here.
is kind of the point. So, all right. What was next for you?
Then, of course, they began walking about and picking up things to look up. It was meeting very old friends.
Yep.
I feel as though the things that they are picking up is not the aspect of very old friends that it is stating right there. It reminds me of the line from Susan of playing chess with gentle, or not gentle giants, that's a moving company in Massachusetts. It is good giants. So I feel as though the coronation rings or the little brooch, all of these things are associated with a memory of someone that they treasured having met.
And
And
that's
so
the
that's
real. Go ahead. Well,
you were saying.
I missed what you were saying. But I was going to say, yeah, that's, and for me, that is the importance of things, is not the thingness themselves, but oh, my aunt made that for me, or my friend gave it to me, or something like that. So it is that reminder of people whom we love.
Indeed.
Yeah. Do you remember? Do you remember? And remembering so member, it's like part of the body. This is remembering. They're putting it back together. It is not just having a memory of things. It is coming to them as their real past, I think. And Edmund's very practical. We mustn't waste the battery. So take what we want and get out again. And this is when Peter says, we must take the gifts. And that's going to be our sacred reading. So if you have anything brief to say on that, go ahead. But otherwise, I'm going to save that for later. Oh.
Yes.
Susan remembering about her horn and where it
Yeah.
is. Bother, bother, bother. And now she's even saying, I must have got lost when we blundered back into that other place. England, I mean. So she's home.
And I find it interesting that she considers going back to England a blunder. I mean, practically it just means a stumbling back into or happening upon or something like that. But in terms of it being blundering, it's just a sense of it being a mistake.
Yeah,
And I
right.
wonder how regret she's held within her heart about having returned and being returned to her former age and what is restored to her now.
Yeah. But she's
I think.
okay. She's got her sword, she's got her bow, and it's fine. So archery and swimming were the things Susan was good at.
I wonder if she would have considered it a blunder if Peter had not reminded her before this that she is a queen here.
Right. Oh yeah. Oh, I think so. Absolutely. She is making, oh, there's a word for this. She's changing within herself. It's almost like she's rearranging. Like every spell is rearranging to be this queen. And I'll think of the right word later and I'll put it in the notes, but oh shoot, I can't think of the right word. I'm sorry.
I'm
Yeah.
sure we'll see it sometime in the Facebook group later.
Right. I'll shout it out. And I think for Peter, when he's taken down his gift, his sword and his shield, and I didn't remember the name. Did we get the name in the first book? Rindon?
Riddun sword, I'm not sure we did.
Yeah. And so here's a little piece where, again, this sword is precious to him. And over the years that he was king in Narnia, it got a name. All the others felt that he was really Peter the High King again. So, and then they managed to go asleep. That was, yeah.
I feel like that's really the climax of the chapter is like
Yeah.
coming to a point where he is the High King again because it restores to them their status as the same.
Right. So they have come home. Oh, I like this so much. It's such an exciting chapter. It's wonderful.
I mean, it's the most prosaic thing we have in the entire book of the kids coming home from vacation and cleaning out the basement. I
Yeah, right. Right. Yeah.
don't know about, but that was the entirety of many of my school breaks, so.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I know. I've talked to people who spent a week away from work. I said, "Oh, did you go somewhere?" No, we painted our living room and we, I go, "Oh, yeah." But well, at least we know the kids didn't just paint clean up the basement. They just found the key things and took them out. So they haven't cleaned everything yet. They didn't take out every carbuncle. I'm just going to use carbuncle as much as I can. So, are we ready to move into our sacred practice?
Yes, please.
Okay. So, like I said, I'm going to do Pardes, which is a Jewish practice. And Pardes is a Persian word for garden and is related to our word for paradise. And so each letter in the word stands for something, the P. Peshat is the surface meaning or literal direct meaning. Remez would be hints or deeper meanings. Allegoric. So here with Lewis, it's okay to have allegory meanings just beyond the literal sense. Darash is the next one, which is to inquire. So comparing, have there been similar occurrences in stories we've read so far in Narnia like this? And in fact, if we want to go back to Tolkien, is there anything that this will remind us of in other parts of books and maybe even other books entirely? We will compare. So does the last. That is the secret or mystery, esoteric, mystical meaning. And if we're lucky, we'll get something. And if we're lucky, we won't. So, it's all okay. So in this garden, we're going to hold up this bit of fruit, just this line from Peter, we must take the gifts. So, can you give us the surface or straight or literal meaning? I know we just sort of said it, but.
Well, we have Edmund insisting that they need to take what they want, and Peter's response to what they want is we must take the gifts. So he has assessed what is necessary.
And just to go a little bit deeper, these were their Christmas gifts that they had gotten long ago in Narnia. And they valued these more than their whole kingdom. So,
Except
Edmund.
for, and that was his.
Yes. Poor Edmund. He doesn't have a gift, but that Well, I'm sure there's he's got greater gifts because he got to have a private chat with Aslan. Okay. So, we must take the gifts. Are there any hints or deep or symbolic meanings to you in that line? We must take the gifts.
Well, having the following line or the setting that you just referenced, the association with Christmas, with the almost sacred nature of these gifts, just for their endowment by someone who is returning with the melting of the ice and the restoration of Narnia as it's meant to be. We must take the gifts, reminds me of gifts of the spirit. And I think that's also tied into why I think of Edmund having no gift, and that is his fault, except what he was given is something we don't know about from having spoken to Aslan.
Yeah, and I think for me, these gifts are also symbols of their whole selves, because they received these gifts before they were kings and queens. The carbuncles and the diamonds and the rubies all come later when they have a castle and thrones, you know? So I think there is something symbolic, and it relates to me also in the coming home, that these gifts to them are to their true selves, no matter who they are. These gifts are for them. So kings or queens or children, so or in between. I think there is a symbolic sense that these are for them. And again, yes, it's interesting that there wasn't something set aside for Edmund. And yet we have to think, I mean, already we see that he is wiser, he is resourceful, he is a good team member with his siblings. So he has had a gift of some kind. He really has. So I think that those are symbolic meanings that come to me. Those are, and then looking for comparisons, seeking, inquiring, any similar occurrences. We must take the gifts that come to you either in Narnia or other things we've looked at.
Well, it is purely your fault that you said you could regress into Tolkien, because I am thinking of we must take the gifts and Bilbo finding a ring of cold metal, and it was a turning point in his career. The Peter and the other children taking the gifts is them reclaiming what it was to be kings and queens of Narnia.
I think of the gifts given by Galadriel as the fellowship is about to leave Lorien, and then how those stay with each fellowship member to the end. So even Boromir is sent off with his, and everyone's gets restored to them if they lost them, or Sam never lets go of his dirt, you know. So that there are certain gifts that are more valuable than anything. And to the end of his days in Middle Earth, Frodo wears his robe from Lorien. So these things, some gifts are just so important. What about ruby slippers? Speaking of coming home,
Original source, they were jeweled slippers, never mentioned as ruby, but
I know there's silver in the book. I know.
I only remember this because I love the musical Wicked and it points that out there.
I see. Well,
But
I
yeah,
yeah.
celebrate your degree.
Right. It helps Dorothy to be at home in Oz and is helping her towards getting home. Helps her in her hero's journey. So, any other gifts? I mean, you mentioned spiritual gifts, but I just wonder, are there any other stories of we must take the gifts that come to you?
Nothing's coming to mind at the moment.
Well, I'll just think about a horn because then, of course, at the very end, how Eowyn and Éomer give Merry a horn.
Yes.
How important that becomes to him. And Susan is missing hers, but there's a very good reason they're back here. And her horn is not lost. So thinking about how, something can be useful even if it's not in your possession is kind of amazing. So yeah, I think that's all that's coming to me through similar occurrences, though I'm sure there's a million, and I'd like to hear what other people think about that. So we must take the gifts. So if you're not driving, close your eyes and hit pause for 30 seconds and see if there is sod that comes to you. What is a mysterious meaning? What secret is revealed to you? We must take the gifts. And 30 seconds of airtime is not good podcasting. So I'll jump in unless you've got something right off.
Oh, I've got something, but you can go ahead.
I think it is reminding me of our very first theme, Welcome What Comes, and it's a reminder that we may receive things in this life that don't appear as gifts. But if we do the work that these young people do of making some meaning out of things, then the difficult things become a gift. And I'll reference that the way Stephen Colbert talks about losing his father and brother. It's this terrible thing that happened. And yet, because of who he is today, he was shaped by that incident. He's proud of the person he is. He loves who he is. He's turned out well. So he has to love that incident too, as awful as that is. And I think that a lot of us who have worked through a grief realize at some point, I never would have had this growth if that didn't happen. And everybody's going to grieve something at some point. So I think we must take the gifts that come to us. And today it might not look like a gift, but I think the secret is do the work and it will be a gift at some point.
Oh, that's great. For me, the word in this sentence that jumped out at me as a so was the we pronoun. I know that Edmund also says, hadn't we better take what we want and get out again? But Peter, in this moment of restoring himself to the High Kingship, make sure that everyone is included in the need for being rewarded, or not necessarily rewarded, but equipped and receive things that can be of benefit to them. And so there is a moment of both equality and equity in this.
Ooh. I like that. What is that saying to you? How is that something that you might take into your day?
To find a way to provide for every person's need in my path in some way without it questioning what the deserving thing is.
That's rich. Yeah, because it's all we. Wonderful. Well, thank you. We must take the gifts. Thank you for joining us in this exciting chapter. And next episode, we will discuss chapter 3 of Prince Caspian, The Dwarf. And our theme is mystery.
Sorry, getting back to the
Getting
agenda
back
because
to the
I
agenda.
have. day.
Okay.
30 seconds of silence does not make for good podcasting.
Okay.
We love hearing from you, and our community is growing stronger every day. If you'd like to join our Facebook community, look for A Sacred Fellowship. Find us on Instagram at A Sacred Fellowship. You can also send an email to asacredfellowship@gmail.com. Thanks to all of you for keeping our spirits up and our thoughts flowing. Please read and comment on this second breakfast at our website, www.asacredfellowship.com.
And we also value the contributions of our Patreon supporters. Your support of the site and hosting costs is much appreciated. If you feel inspired to join their ranks, please look at our options on www.patreon.com/asacredfellowships. Perks have ranged from patron shoutouts to literary themed presents, and we do appreciate every dollar.
Speaking of things we appreciate, we got two emails from Philip in the last few days. One of them was to let us know that we'd accidentally uploaded only 35 seconds of our episode. We fixed that, or rather, Lorianne did very kindly. But thanks to Philip for making sure we were aware of that problem. But then once we got to the actual thing, he emailed us on Friday and said, "Hi, all. Yay, I got the episode. I think it was important for Edmund to be the one who caught on first to the magic and then took the lead in their transition back to Narnia as a literary device to cement for the reader the rehabilitation that happened at the end of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Bright and secret, secrets are often kept in the dark, and where those secrets might bring some shame if exposed, dark gets a bad rap. However, some secrets are just not yet known. I think the secret garden was bright. Also, as undergrads, we would go spelunking through the undertunnels of MIT to find spaces that were blocked off and unusable and hard to find. We had a word for those architecturally wasted spaces, but I can't remember it." Also, side note from here. Okay, Philip, if you ever come to visit Boston, please take me to Cambridge and show me some of these undertunnels at MIT. Okay, getting back to the conversation. There was one whose secret was shared in initiation to this tradition that was dark on entry, but being engineers, lighting was strung inside and the light bulbs maintained so that became quite bright. Sad places. I like that places take on the investiture of its occupants, and the place is sad when the occupants are not there. Imagine encountering Rivendell centuries after Elrond had left. I think it would still feel like a safe haven, but a little sad as it no longer could present to you what you exactly needed and was a little frayed about the edges. As the Pevensies eventually discover that these are the ruins of Cair Paravel, it should have had a more Welsh spelling. He spells it with a F instead of an V and then an I an E instead of an I. But maybe they are already subconsciously sorting out that these are the ruins of their home of 15 years or so, which for them they just left last year in presenting this description. They were the investiture in that space, and maybe they are feeling the weight of the entropy of decay from their absence and also hope in that the foundations are still there to build upon. Thanks, Phil.
Thanks, Phil.
As always, yes. That comes to the end of things.
That does. Well, we shall not cease from exploration. And the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. T.S. Eliot.
No matter you.
Marie.